We are rocking and rolling with my guest, Dave Politis, who at the third volume of his book, Missing 411, is out. And it's incredible. It's chilling. It's spooky, scary. If you are familiar with the first two volumes or you've heard our interviews with Dave, you know that in many of these cases, most of these cases, in fact, the people who are found, they're not found, or they come back and they're unable to explain where they've been. They're either stunned. A lot of them have handicaps. They can't speak, or they're too young to express where they've been. But in a handful of cases, the people who are found alive, youngsters in many cases, are able to give clues to where they've been. And some of those clues are just astounding, jaw-dropping. We're going to get into one of those, the case of John Doe, where he was and what he remembers from the time when he was missing, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Dave Politis, the new book, Missing 411, North America and Beyond, looks at new clusters, also has fresh cases from clusters you've talked about before. I seem to recall that you did talk about Mount Shasta cases before, but this new one, this John Doe case, missing child, 3 years old, is a jaw-dropper. Tell us the story.
Well, it's interesting because I actually heard of this case years ago when it was evolving. And the reason being, this is one of those strange coincidences, is that John Doe disappeared along a creek river that I used to fish as a kid. And I've probably been there at least 50 times. And the area is world-class fly fishing, very, very thick woods. There's a couple of real famous Hollywood types that own hundreds of acres in the area. It's just pristine wilderness, great fishing. What happened was, is he was there with his family, and happened on October 1st, 2010. About 6:30 p.m., he disappeared. And one of the things that I didn't state earlier on is that that late afternoon, early evening is the prime time for a disappearance. Anytime between, let's say, 2:30 and 6:30 or 7 at night is the time that these things seem to happen. This area of this disappearance has a very long history of strange things. I mean, people have said that there are people called Lemurians that live beneath Mount Shasta. There's been a history of Bigfoot sightings in this area. There's been tons of UFOs flying around Shasta. So, and I've written about a cluster in my past Western book about Shasta specifically, a cluster of disappearances. Well, this boy's 3 years old. He disappears from his parents. They immediately call the sheriff. A big search starts, and they don't find him. I mean, they looked everywhere. This area doesn't have a lot of low ground coverage. It's a lot of big trees with a lot of open area underneath. But near the rivers and things and some of the trails, there is some shrubbery, but not a lot. So anyhow, we fast forward 5 hours. At about 11:30 at night, they find this boy sitting in the middle of a bush in a thicket, and he doesn't say anything. He's taken home. Parents talk to him. He's in sort of a stunned disbelief. So finally, the next day, they get talking to him, and they said, well, you know, explain what happened. And he goes, I really don't know. He says, I just kind of disappeared. And, well, where were you? And he tells this story that he is taken into a cave, and he thinks it's underground. And he says, I know it's dark outside, but when I'm in this cave, I could see the entrance, and it's light outside. And he says that he's with a woman that looks exactly like his grandma. And originally, he thought it was his grandma. But then he said that in the cave, there's a lot of other things that look like people, but they're all robots and they're not moving. And he says after a while, he figures out that this woman really isn't his grandma, even though she's really nice to him and very polite, but he believes she's a robot as well.
She's got sparks around her head or something like that?
Yeah, he made some kind of comment about, there was some kind of light or sparks or unusual light coming from her head. And then he says that she was real nice until she started to get pushy, and she took out some sticky paper and laid it on the ground and told him he had to poop on it. And he told her that he didn't have to go, and she got mad. And he says, now, as I'm sitting there, he says, they asked him, what else did you see there? And he said he saw a lot of small guns and things around the outside perimeter of the cave, and they all had a lot of dust on them. So then you kind of fast forward a little bit, and the boy went to go spend time at that grandmother's house the following weekend. And he tells the story to the grandmother. Well, the grandmother then told us that 3 weeks before the boy disappeared, the grandmother and her husband were at that exact creek river spending the night. And they actually woke up in the middle of the night because the grandmother felt a pain at the base of her neck. And she had her husband look, and there was a small bloody spot at the base of the neck. And she says, you know, I don't know if it's related, but I just wanted to tell you that I thought that was strange. I happened to be there where this point he disappeared, and he sees a grandmother, and I have this bloody spot on my neck. I don't know what to think of it. Make a long story short, the boy's fine. He's developing fine. He hasn't disappeared anymore. But that is probably the most unusual story that I've ever heard about a small boy disappearing.
Yeah, it's like Granny had a DNA sample taken from her when she was there before. I mean, I don't know if we get too weird about it, but that's what it sounds like.
That's what we thought.
How many other cases, for those who haven't heard your previous interviews, how many other cases do you have where children are able to come back, they're alive, and they're able to give some kind of clue about where they've been? I know you don't have any exactly like that, but you do have some other versions of pretty weird tales.
You know, it's very, very unusual. There are a very small group of cases where a child comes back or they're found and they tell unusual stories. There's some from the East Coast where the person says, you know, I saw this giant thing standing behind a tree and it was kind of swaying back and forth. And then I don't really remember much, and then you kind of found me. Other times, there's a story out of, I think it was Arizona, where three kids disappeared from a picnic ground, and they were gone for a day and a half. And when the searchers finally found them, they walked up on them, and the kids immediately went down and were hiding. Searchers walked up to them and said, "What are you doing? Why are you hiding?" And he says, "We thought you might have been the 8 people again."
Wasn't there a girl who talked about a story about a talking dog?
Yes, and that's... You really don't know what to make about some of these stories because they're so outlandish that you don't know what to believe.
In the UFO world, you have what's known as screen memories, or people who claim they've been abducted. And I know you don't want to veer into that, but they claim to have had some sort of an abduction, and a screen memory is implanted into their head that what they saw wasn't an alien, it was a big-eyed owl, that sort of thing. It's almost like an implanted memory in some of these kids' stories.
Well, you know, one thing I tell people that are in the Bigfoot world, and I tell law enforcement people who I talk to today, is that I think one thing that's unique about our group is that we read everything we can get our hands on related to something like this. And there was a guy named John Mack who wrote a book about UFO abductees. And you read about the circumstances and what they find out from the individual during hypnosis. And we've always thought that it'd be fascinating if we could get some of these people at a conference room and have them go through hypnosis. And I think the similarities between them and them knowing that there's other people just like them out there, it would be fascinating.
No, but you haven't done that? You have never had a regression?
You know, I haven't. And the reason for that is that when I first got into this, a group of missing organizations had heard what we were doing. And two of them got a hold of me, and they're really nice people. And they said, just be careful, Dave. And when you make that approach on somebody who has gone through an incident like that, they can easily take what you're doing the wrong way, and that you're trying to profit from their loss and from their injury, and a lot of people don't want to be talked to. So kind of the stance that we've taken is that if people want to talk to us, absolutely, we're going to open up and do everything we can. On a few cases, like the Dennis Martin disappearance at the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, we did approach his dad, and we got a lengthy interview out of that. But we're very careful about that.
Yeah, I can understand that. Maybe what you need is somebody who was abducted as a child who's alive now, hearing this for the first time, and needs to come forward and try to retrieve the memories of what really happened to him.
Right.
So if that's the case, folks, give us a call. Let's go to talk about some of the new clusters that you discuss in this volume 3. Mount Rainier National Park. I mean, these are as good a stories as you've had in any of the books. And I think our listeners up in Washington State are going to be pretty spooked by it. Go ahead and tell us a few of these tales.
Well, I think one of the best ones, and we got through a Freedom of Information Act request, we got the case file on this person, and his name was Joseph Wood Jr., 34 years old. Disappeared July 8, 1999. This person is unusual. And in the thousands of cases we've reviewed, this is only the second black man that I've ever written about that's disappeared under these under the criteria we've set down. Joseph was a super, super smart guy, Yale graduate, Eagle Scout. He was an editor for a New York newspaper. Then he moved on and was a publishing editor at a publishing company. And he was in Seattle for a conference. And during one of the days, they had a break, and so he decided to go to Mount Rainier and do some bird watching. He was an outdoor enthusiast and a bird enthusiast. And he went to a place called Longmire Parking Lot, parked his rental car on a beautiful day, and sat down on a very, very large trail and started to hike up. And it was a nice day. There was still some snow on the ground. And as he's walking up the trail, he comes across another bird watcher. And they stop and they talk to each other and they have a great conversation. They kind of compare notes. This guy says this is how far you can go up the trail and then there's going to be too much snow. And it wasn't that much further. And Joe said good. And they separated. He walked further up. That was the last time he was ever seen. And again, an established trail in good weather in the middle of the week. Broad daylight, disappeared. Huge search. What I tell people about Joseph is that not only was he a brilliant guy, but he was also an Eagle Scout. And I think that's the first Eagle Scout I've ever written about as well. And Eagle Scouts are trained in the outdoors. They have to do good in their lessons. Otherwise, they never reach that rank. And you have to have a certain amount of common sense to reach that level as well. And that area of Mount Rainier that he disappeared in isn't one of the most rugged areas of the mountain. It's a pretty mundane area. And searchers were able to track down that witness he saw, and he said there was nothing unusual. It was a great conversation. He was upbeat. We talked about the birds, etc. So anyhow, after about a 10-day search, the Park Service was ready to call it off, and his family and a newspaper in New York called The Village Voice wrote an article about it, his disappearance. And again, just like we've talked about earlier, abduction comes into the scenario. And abduction comes in because searchers and family members have a difficult time reconciling what happens to these people. If somebody disappears, chances are they're going to start dropping things when they get stressed. So in Joe's case, he might drop his book, he might drop his map, he might drop a backpack, whatever he's carrying. In these instances, they find nothing. It's so strange. And in Joe's case, they never found anything. They never found his body, they never found his coat, books, maps, nothing. And so a very, very unusual case. But as we sort of suspected about Rainier years ago, the more we got into it, the more strangeness went into it. And when you talk about the abduction scenario, you don't really think about abductions on the side of the mountain or abductions when people are hiking. You tend to think of abductions around parking lots maybe or around populated areas near a lodge. But on a trail where there's only two cars in the parking lot, Joe's and the guy he saw on the trail, the idea that an abduction is going to occur there, almost unheard of. And how that could have been accomplished, that's a million-dollar question. And it wouldn't have been in a time of the year when weed was growing up on the mountain. That wouldn't have been it. And guaranteed there wouldn't be anybody with a meth lab on the side of the mountain because it's normally way, way too cold. So it's a big, giant whodunit. And
you had another disappearance on Mount Rainier, a little girl. This was a long time ago, not as recent as the Joseph Wood case, but a little girl, 4-year-old girl, who was found alive.
Yeah, and there are so many of those little kids, say, under the age of 6 or 7, that vanish in that exact scenario, that it's actually on our end, it gets to be, you get to be numb to it. But the reality of it is, when she disappeared, she shouldn't have disappeared. She was in close proximity to her parents, and she's found again uphill from where she passed, from where she was lost. But and her name was Marcella Romisky back in 1950. She was 4 years old. But I like to talk about things that are really, really abnormal. And there was a guy named Eric Lewis. I don't know if you remember that one. It disappeared in July of 2010. 57 years old, absolutely phenomenal shape, climbed as a career all over the world, and was climbing with some super experienced climbers on the side of Rainier. And they were doing some technical climbing high up. They were pulling each other up, and Eric was on the other end, and all of a sudden the line kind of goes loose. So they pull it up, and the carabiner at the other end is there, but there's no rope attached to it. So they decide they'll go down, and because they're yelling for him, and they're not getting anything, and they can't see him. And we're talking about nothing unusual here. They're climbing the mountain. A guy's attached to the line. He's over the side of the cliff. He didn't fall. There's no screaming or yelling. There's nothing. They looked for him. They called in the National Park climbing team. This guy was never found. And he was attached, and they were starting to pull. The rope went limp. The carabiner's attached to the other end. Eric's gone and never seen again.
You say in the book that he was among the top 1% climbers in the world?
Per the National Park Service climbers that were there. They said he knew that mountain better than most of the professionals that climb it.
He would have had to have disconnected the rope himself on purpose, almost?
Yeah, exactly. It didn't break because it was never attached, and they said it made absolutely no sense.
I don't want to backtrack too much, but I wanted to just to mention that one of the reasons I brought up the case of Marcella, that four-year-old girl we were talking about a moment ago, is when she was found alive, we had talked about clothing that was weird. Her dress was on backwards, and there was something weird about the laces of her shoes.
Exactly, and her mother made that observation and said, you know, she doesn't even know how to dress herself that way, and she doesn't know how to tie her shoes. And they were tied in a way that she had never seen. The entire thing didn't make sense, but it did make some sense when you look at the clothing and the shoe issue that we've seen on many other cases. They're off or they're gone.
It's almost like some of these crazy abduction encounters that people report is that it's almost made to look ridiculous on purpose.
Yeah.
So that no one will believe it.
Right.
We're going to take a break in about a minute, but I wanted to let's go to the other side of the country, the Adirondacks in New York. You mentioned that as a new cluster area that you focus on in the book. How many cases, first of all?
I think in total there's at least eight, maybe nine, because there were some in the Eastern book that first came out, namely a small boy named Douglas Legg who disappeared, and tracking dogs did track him all the way around Lake Placid and back down the other side. And I don't know if people remember that. He disappeared on some family acreage and completely under someone's watchful eye. The boy was never seen again. And the area he would have had to gone through in the high peaks of New York, a normal man couldn't have made it. And yet tracking dogs not only went north, they went north way up over the top of some of these mountains and then back down around the other side of Lake Placid, and then he was lost in the middle of a swamp. That really started us to pay attention to the Adirondacks and what was happening there.
We'll come back to the Adirondacks. There's a case of a guy named Steve Thomas that I want to talk about. Then we'll talk about some foreign country cases as well. Much more to come with Dave Politis, author of Missing 411. We're talking with Dave Politis, author of Missing 411, now out with Volume 3. When we come back, we talk about the Adirondacks, maybe pop over to Florida and talk about some cases there. The Sequoia National Park, and then some foreign countries as well. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dave Politis, will get back to cases, specifically the Adirondacks, in a moment. One thing we haven't touched on, and I want to at least cover it briefly, is the lack of cooperation from government agencies. That's another really interesting aspect of this whole mystery, is that the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, those agencies that you would think would want to keep a list of missing persons just to figure out how many people might be vanishing from within their purview. They don't keep a list like that, and they certainly are not very cooperative when it comes to sharing records, are they?
No, they're not. And I think the audience needs to understand that why we went after the National Park Service from the very beginning is because they're one of the few groups that has a large law enforcement contingency that patrols wooded areas, namely national parks. And they have a law enforcement group that's federally trained, probably better trained than most municipal small law enforcement agencies in the U.S. And they go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. They're dedicated law enforcement people. They don't pick up garbage. They don't clean campsites. They don't do those kind of things. They are true professionals, and they're assigned to the parks for patrol. And a subcategory of that is they have special agents that are the detectives in the parks that do the follow-up on criminal activity and missing people. And when things get really complicated, they call in the FBI, and the FBI will take the case. So we knew that these people had been trained at the highest level in law enforcement. They know the needs for documentation. They write quality reports. I've read hundreds of them, and these people are professionals. So when we first asked them for a list of missing people from their park system, and they stated that they didn't have any lists, we thought it had to be in the writing we were doing and the semantics of it, and we resubmitted again, and they said, no, we don't have these lists. We don't keep track of missing people. And I tell the audience when I'm speaking is that you look at any website from any medium-sized to large police department in the nation, and on that website, there's going to be a section about missing people in that jurisdiction. A lot of sheriff's office carry those information. Interesting part is you won't find that anywhere in the national parks. And when you dig a little deeper, they tell you that, no, we don't keep track of missing people inside of our parks. And when you ask them why, they say initially, well, we don't have the wherewithal to keep that information, but we're planning a computer system in the future that's going to be able to do that, and we will have that. And that's what we were told 4 years ago. They still don't have it.
I mean, come on. How hard is that?
Exactly, George. Now, what I do tell, and I actually put a poster up on the wall when I'm giving a talk, and I say, this isn't rocket science, people. With a piece of binder paper and a clipboard, and you divide that binder paper into name, date of disappearance, location, and the final disposition, and there is your tracking mechanism for almost every park in the nation. And this isn't hard to do. Now, one of the guys on our team has been head of one of the bigger law enforcement agencies in the U.S., and when he was told that the park system wanted to charge us $1.4 million for them to establish a list of missing people in their system, and $34,000 for a list of missing people from Yosemite, he said, Dave, guys, you got to think about this. If they want to charge you that much money, and they want to take the heat for not maintaining a list, as that is absolutely politically incorrect, that heat must be a lot less than they'd take if they did release all that information to you.
Well, for example, Yosemite, you say that is probably the number one cluster in the country. Let's say there's 24 cases of missing people. It's probably a lot more, but that you've been able to dig up the records about. How hard is that to maintain a list of a couple dozen names?
We try to rationalize it here. It makes no sense at all. I mean, we could talk about thousands of law enforcement agencies in North America and Canada where you know and I know that missing people are something that everybody tracks, everybody understands. Everybody can go to a site and they can pick it up. National Park System doesn't.
It's like the mayor in Jaws doesn't want people to stop going in the water.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
I noticed in the new volume that you make a distinction that I think is important because it further complicates things, and that is that people are missing persons for a while, and then the search ends and they give up and they're legally dead. So they're taken off a missing persons list. So it really it distorts the true picture of how many people are actually missing.
And that's a very confusing aspect to this entire situation. The National Park Service has a classification called missing presumed dead. And no longer missing. Now, there are cases out there where, say, an adult disappears and the family has to get them to declare dead to get the benefits.
Right.
So they go to court, they get a judge to say, okay, we're going to classify him as deceased. He's been gone for a year. All of a sudden, he's not on any records anymore either. Now, as more time goes by, it's harder and harder to find those files if there's nobody looking for you anymore.
Basically, you've been able to find the files because you go to newspapers, databases, online records, things of that sort, but not through any cooperation of the government.
It's very hard. There, I will say this about the National Park Service. When you take them by the hand and you walk them to the case and you give them the case name, the location, the time, all of a sudden they can usually, I say, find that case. There's a series of cases out of Crater Lake National Park, and I was told that from, say, 1978 and 1992, all the cases were thrown away because they didn't have any place to keep them. And I think in the day of microfiche and things, that's highly suspect, but that's what they said. There's a case right now of a girl that disappeared about 2 months ago in the Grand Canyon, in Grand Canyon National Park. This girl was actually from Colorado. She was on a month-long trip with a group floating down the river. They stopped at an area where a small creek comes into the Colorado. They were camping. In the middle of the night, the girl disappeared. The case is classified as a missing persons case, and they all stated at the beginning, oh, you know, her body will come up. She just fell in during the middle of the night. Well, other people have said, no, this girl's done this many, many times. She's a seasoned camper. She knows where the river is in the middle of the night. If she had to go to the bathroom, she knows where to walk. Something else happened. Well, it's one of those really unusual cases. I have contacted the Park Service twice now, and twice I've been refused. And what they said was is that the case is still in process, and they're still investigating. Again, I go back to them and I say, is it a straight missing persons case? They say yes, but they're still not releasing the case yet. It's one of those unusual things that happens every once in a while.
Let's jump forward. I mentioned about Steve Thomas. This is a guy who went hiking with five of his friends in the Adirondacks, northern New York, and vanished. What's unusual about that case? This is from 1976.
This is one of those really fascinating cases where all of these guys were outdoors people. They were on a break from a community college, Onondaga Community College. Steve was 19 years old. And they were on the side of a mountain called Mount Marcy. And they had stopped at a place called Hopkins Lean-To to kind of spend the night, put up their tents, and have fun. And it was the five buddies and their dog. And as they're getting all their things together to camp out for the night, Steve says, hey, I'm just going to walk up this trail a little more. I'll be right back. I'm just going to get my legs going again. And he walked out of sight wearing a yellow rain slicker. And it was the last time anybody ever saw him. He was in a good state of mind. He was having fun. Nothing strange, unusual to him physically or mentally. He didn't have any disabilities. At about 10 p.m., they started to get really nervous because bad weather was coming into the area, wind, rain, and some light snow. The guys got out, walked up the trail a little bit, yelling for him, screaming for him, looking for him, nothing. They came back into their tent, and as they originally tried to leave, they tried to bring the dog with them, and the dog wouldn't leave the tent. And when they came back to the tent, the dog was whining and would not move from the inside of the tent. Now, flash forward a few weeks, Steve had a brother named Bob Thomas, and Bob actually committed his life to trying to find Steve. And the rangers in that area said, Bob Thomas knows Mount Marcy better than anybody. And the following summer after Steve disappeared, Bob and his dog were out searching, and they actually found the body of another climber named Buddy Atkinson. And his dog started to dig through the snow, and they found this guy who'd been dead for a couple years. That's how thorough Bob and the search group was in looking for Steve. Steve's never been found. He's one of a group of people in this area of the Adirondacks that disappears, is missing, you find nothing. One thing about this case that we haven't talked about before, that is bright-colored clothing. And I've written about that in the other books, and there seems to be a correlation to people who wear bright colors and they disappear.
Yeah, that's a pretty weird aspect. Let's jump to, I promised that we'd talk a little bit about foreign countries. Canada, you've got some amazing cases all the way across from British Columbia to Nova Scotia. Which of the Canadian cases do you think are best exemplify this mystery and jump out at you?
You know, there's a case out of the western area of Canada involving a lady that was a lookout tower fire spotter, and her last name was Stewart, Stephanie Stewart. She was an older lady. She was in her 70s. She'd been doing the job for decades, and she was in the tower. This is an isolated road up and down to it. This is, I wrote about in the Western book, and in the middle of the night, she disappeared, and somebody came up to see her, and she was gone. And Stephanie, again, was an older person in good health, but she wasn't the type of person that could really or would really get out and start moving around. She had water on the stove. What was missing were the most unusual things: her blanket and her alarm clock in her room. And some people may say, well, you know, a rogue killer drove up that road, kidnapped her, and took her. But from a law enforcement perspective, that would be the last thing that a serial killer or a murderer would do. Because this road going up there is like 6 or 7 miles long. It's a dirt road, one way up, one way down. If you're a killer, you don't want to be taking a road like that because there's too much of a chance someone's going to see you and spot you and identify you. And it just doesn't make sense. They searched for her for days, and they never found anything. All of a sudden after that, the Canadian Natural Resources Group started to change the way they did things with lookout people. And, you know, we started to look at lookout towers in the United States as well, and there's a lot of weird things that have happened around those towers at night and during the day that I can't say are directly related to Stephanie's disappearance, but they go to show that there's a lot of unusual events that happen around them.
What is the level of cooperation that you get from Canadian authorities, or have you even tried to see if they have records? Do they keep records about disappearances in parks, for example?
That's a great, great question. And they have something very similar to our Freedom of Information Act, but they only respond to Canadian citizens. Luckily, I got a couple of buddies that are Canadians, and they do the dirty work for us. And phenomenally, they don't carry those records either.
Let's jump to Australia, down under. What made you suspect that would be a place where this kind of activity takes place? And give me a representative case from down under.
Well, you know, Australia in some ways is a lot like the U.S. They have topography that's really different. And right away, when the first books came out, there was a lot of interest from Australian residents. And I got a lot of emails and things, and probably got sent maybe 50 cases, and 48 out of the 50 didn't qualify and didn't meet the criteria. There were a couple that did. One involved a boy who was climbing a mountain. And on this mountain, there's a lake that's within sight and not that far away. He goes on his cell phone, and he calls, and he says, I need some assistance. And it isn't real clear what's wrong, but he's on this mountain, and then the phone goes dead. And searchers go out, and they search the mountain, and they don't find anything. And days, weeks go by, they find this guy on the side of the mountain in a boulder area, deceased. And he had water with him when he made the climb. He didn't have water with him at the time. And they stated that he died of exposure and dehydration. And honest to gosh, at the bottom of this mountain, probably less than a quarter of a mile away, is the biggest lake in the world, in this part of the country. It doesn't make any sense at all. He was in perfect health. It's a very, very strange case that nobody that was sending me this information believed the facts about it.
I know I'm jumping all over the world here, but trying to cover some ground. I can't think of two countries more different than Iceland and Indonesia. The one thing they have in common, they both start with I, but you've got cases from both of those countries. Do you want to touch on either of those?
I'll tell you about the Iceland case, and that's not necessarily a missing persons case. It's a societal belief that I was told about and I looked into, and there's a phenomenal concurrent element there between us and Iceland. That being is that I've stated in many of the books that there is correlation between people disappearing around boulders, in boulder fields, etc., and I couldn't put my finger on it. Somebody sends me a story that people in Iceland believe that spirits live in boulders, and these spirits come out of the boulders, and they do things. Meaning that, let's say you lived in an isolated area and you kept your hammer out, they would take the hammer and they would move it, or they would take tools and they'd disappear. Sometimes if you disturb them the wrong way, they might do bad things. Well, I looked into it, and there's a group that actually made a movie about this, and it's on YouTube. I name it in the book. I could never even pronounce it. But the Icelandic people believe in these spirits so much that when they build roads, they don't displace large boulders. They'll make the road go around them, even if they could be moved. In some cities, the boulders have names and addresses. It's phenomenally... I read this. I couldn't believe it because it fits in with people disappearing around boulders. Doesn't make sense. There's not that many places you can go. Yet these people have known about these spirits that come out and do strange things, mischievous things, and sometimes bad things, and they've had this belief system for hundreds of years.
I know it seems people can cross that off and say, oh, it's just folklore, but as Jacques Vallée has written about folklore in connection with UFO cases and beings, fairies, trolls, leprechauns, things of that sort, the modern equivalent, they become aliens, you know. And is there a connection, is there something comparable, say, in the Indonesian disappearances?
Well, again, we go back to the bright colors. I was on a show with Whitley Strieber, and Whitley had read my books. In fact, Whitley writes the back cover for my current book. But he said, Dave, you know, I read your book, and I immediately thought about cases in Indonesia where people had disappeared, and the villages in this area always tell people not to go into the woods wearing bright colors, otherwise you're going to be taken. And it turns out that there was a guy from Europe that was living in this Sulawesi village who validated everything that Whitley was saying, and that there's been a whole string of people that have disappeared, and they didn't know about, there were visitors and things, they didn't know about this bright colored abduction scenario that is related. It was very strange.
You're very careful to not jump to conclusions. Your conclusions in this new book is like one page long, but I'm going to press you a little bit when we come back to see if your thinking has evolved on this at all. And we'll be opening up the phone lines. A lot of you have been on the phones ever since Dave Politis came on the air tonight. So we'll get to your calls coming up here soon on Coast to Coast AM.